I'm going to talk about density and differentiation theorem for sparse sets. Now, I noticed that the schedule has me speaking from 11:30 to 2 o'clock. I do hope that you guys don't expect me to actually go on for that long, unless you'd like me to do karaoke or something. I would also hope that nobody's planning to come here for the last, just for the last hour of my lecture. So what I want to talk about is joint work with Malavika Pramanik. Work that we started during the program in spring 2008. We're also grateful to one of the long-term participants, Neil Lev, who introduced us to some of these questions. To motivate this work, I would like to start with the Lebesgue differentiation theorem. It says the following. Suppose that I'm just going to state it in one dimension. Suppose that we have a function f which is locally integrable on R. Then the averages of f on small intervals converge to f. If you look at the averages over intervals centered at, say, x of length 2r of f of y, and then take the limit as r goes to 0, then this converges to f of x for almost every x. Now, the problem that we would like to consider is what happens if, instead of taking averages over intervals, try to take averages over some other more complicated things. For example, if you replace, say, minus r by a one-sided interval from 0 to r and then add that to x, then this is not going to change. That's pretty easy to deduce from the Lebesgue theorem. Likewise, if instead of 0 r you take, say, r over 2 to r or any positive fraction of the interval from minus r to r, you have the same result. Now, the interesting question is what happens if you do not take a positive fraction of that? So what if you take averages over quote-unquote sets of measure zero? Now, that question doesn't exactly make sense as I just stated it, so instead we're going to look at averages with respect to singular measures. And that's the question that I'm going to be focusing on. Let me state it in a little bit more detail. Here's what we want to know. Is there a singular measure call it mu such that if you take the averages with respect to that measure, the limit as r goes to 0 of the integral of s of x plus r y d mu of y, is that going to converge to f of x for almost every x, and this is with respect to the Lebesgue measure. The idea is that say this is your x, and then your singular measure mu is bordered on some interval. This here gives you averages of f over translated and rescaled copies of mu. So you take averages over singular sets that sort of focus on x eventually. Two things that can be said immediately about it. First of all, that there's obviously no reason why it should be true for all singular measures. It's actually going to be, we did write a 60-something page paper about it. So. The second thing that I want to mention is that I need to add a condition here, because otherwise there's a trivial answer. Like, for example, I could take my singular measure to be the delta at x. So, or the delta at 0, rather. So I want to exclude that type of pathological examples, and I'm going to do it by assuming that mu is going to be supported on the interval from 1 to 2. And that way, when I look at my averages of s, I'm going to be taking averages over sets that sit somewhere here. This is basically to prevent the case when my measure is just the delta function at the point in question. So the short answer, which I'm going to elaborate on in a second, is that it's yes. For functions f locally integrable on r for p greater than 1, but it's not possible if f is just in L1. Now, before I give you an exact statement of this result, I want to explain a little bit about how the mu is going to be constructed. Mu is going to be constructed. Using a counter iteration, so there's going to be a process where we start with the interval from 1 to 2. We subdivide it into a large number of intervals. Say n1, we're going to choose, say, n1 to the 1 minus epsilon 1 of them, and we keep those. Now, the details of how to actually do that are going to be explained a little bit later on. So these are the intervals that get to live at stage one. At step two, we subdivide each of the step one intervals. We subdivide each one into n2 intervals, so the total number of intervals is now n1, n2. Then again, we choose some of them. So let's say that these here get to live at the next stage, and so on. And then you keep iterating that. The parameters nk and epsilon k are going to be fixed eventually to get the right dimension and the right intersection properties. I'm going to call these sets S1, S2, and so on. So in this way we get a sequence of sets S1, S2, all subsets of 1 to 2. We're going to set it up so that the measure of sk goes to 0 as k goes to infinity. Now, our main result is going to be stated first in terms of the finite iterations, and then we're also going to get, as a corollary, the statement that I mentioned here for the measures. Okay, so the main theorem is as follows. There exists a sequence of sets SK as above. Such that the maximal operator defined as mf of x is the supremum of averages over translated and rescaled copies of the sk sets. Integral over sk f of x plus r y dy. The supremum is taken, there should be an absolute value here. The supremum is taken over all scaling parameters are. And also overall indices K. And then the result is that this maximal operator is bounded on all LP of R with P greater than 1. Now that's the first conclusion. Now to get to the statement about measures, we need to take the limit here as k goes to infinity. So let's label this 1. Then we need to have that the rescaled densities on the SKs converge to a measure. There's a measure mu supported on the set S, which is the intersection of the SK, so that S has measure 0. Such that the uniform densities of uniform densities on SK, 1 over SK measure times the characteristic function of SK converge to mu weakly. And then we also have the boundedness of the maximal operator for the measure mu. If we define the maximal operator associated with mu to be the supremum over R positive, the integral of S of x plus R y d mu of y, then this is also bounded on LP for all p greater than 1. As a corollary, we get the differentiation theorem. And that says the following. With the SK as in the first theorem, we have the differentiation theorem for the measure mu. So for all S in LP local of R, we have the limit as R goes to 0 of the average of S with respect to translated and rescaled mu is equal to f of x almost everywhere. And we also get a similar statement at the finite stages of the iteration. The limit as r goes to 0 of see, let's, I'm gonna have to write it as 1 over fk integral of f of x plus ry dy over fk minus f of x. This is gonna be 0 for almost every x, and moreover, in here I can put the supremum over k. Now, I'm gonna tell you a little bit about how this gets proved in a moment, but first I want to make several comments. The first one is that this fails for p equal to 1. And this is due to David Price. That was last year. Basically what happened is I met with David Price in Barcelona and we discussed a preliminary version of that paper. We didn't know at the time whether p equal to 1 would or would not work, but we explained some reasons why we thought they might not. And then the following day he sent me a short text file containing the counterexample to the differentiation theorem for p equal to 1. The second comment is that there is a lower dimensional version of this result. The set S defined here in the main theorem has Lebesgue measure 0 but has of dimension 1. However, we can also get a similar result for sets of dimension less than 1. Say 1 minus epsilon. At this point, I think we can take the epsilon down to or up to 1/3. The price that we pay is that the range of p is now not going to go all the way to 1, but instead we're going to have to stop at p equal to 1 plus epsilon over 1 minus epsilon. We don't know whether this dependence on epsilon is optimal. So I'm going to write that down here in case somebody would like to work on it. There is also a variant of both theorems where the maximal operator is bounded from LP to LQ. to be greater than 1, Q greater than or equal to P, and less than infinity. And then the maximal operator needs to be modified. There's an R to the A factor inserted in it, where the exponent depends on the P and Q. Okay, and one more thing that I want to mention, and that has to do with the history of the problem, is that if you take the last statement I wrote here, the differentiation property for the finite iterations, let's call it star, then a special case of that had been proved earlier by Aversa and Price. Namely, if you restrict star just to characteristic functions of sets, that was proved by Aversa and Price. It's never really been published except for an Italian preprint that we weren't quite able to read. It's 1995. They called it the affine invariant density property. And then the sequence of sets SK was called an affine invariant density system. The idea is that just like there's a density theorem associated with the Lebesgue differentiation theorem, suppose that you just consider characteristic functions of sets here, of measurable sets, then you get the Lebesgue density theorem instead. Likewise, you could consider density theorems of this variety. And that's what Aversa and Price did. They wrote up this construction of sets for which they got the affine invariant density property in that sense. Now, when I talked to Price about it, he wasn't entirely sure that everything in there is correct, but it looks similar enough to our proof that it probably works, or at least could be made to work. They also raised the question of whether there was a differentiation theorem corresponding to that, and that they didn't know how to prove. So they just left that as an open question. And at one point, Aversa also communicated that to us. That was pretty much our motivation for looking at that type of things to begin with. Now, before I go on to the proof, I'd like to point out maybe a slightly different point of view on this sort of thing, which is the following. If you look at the statement up here, the maximal operator associated with a singular measure, and then you stop thinking about dimension one for a moment, there have been theorems of that type known in higher dimensions, for quite a long time. For example, maximal operators associated with surface with Lebesgue measure on surfaces. And specifically, maybe as a last comment, I would like to encourage you to compare the statement up there to the spherical maximal theorem. This is due to Gauguin and Stein. And it says that if you define the spherical maximal operator in d dimensions by saying that ms of x is the supremum over r, a positive integral over s d minus 1 f of x plus ry d sigma of y, sigma being the surface measure on the d minus 1 dimensional sphere. So basically, you take a point in rd and then you take averages over spheres centered at that point, and then you shrink the radius of that sphere to zero. And as always, I forgot the absolute value. Then this operator is bounded on LP for p greater than d over d minus 1. And that range is known to be sharp. Okay, so if you compare this to that here, and especially to the variant for lower dimensions, then you can think of it as sort of the analog of that. In one dimension, instead of having a sphere which has dimension less than the full dimension of the ambient space, you have a set of some sort, which again has dimension lower than the dimension of the space. Then you have the boundedness of the maximal operator on some on LP for some range of P, and moreover, if you look at that range of P carefully, here as the epsilon goes to zero, the range of P is going to approach one. Now, if you start thinking about, you know, the ratio of the dimension of the sphere to the dimension of the space, then the same sort of thing happens in this setting. If you take d to infinity, then this is also going to go to 1. Okay, so that was just some general philosophizing. Now a couple of words about the proof. Now, I'm going to have to skip out a lot of things, unless you actually would like me to keep going until 2 o'clock. Let's see. Well, thank you for the idea, Michael. Okay, so the idea of proof, and I'm just going to try to explain it in the case when P is greater than 2, and then I'm going to say about two sentences about how to extend it to all P greater than 1. First of all, we discretize and linearize the problem, and this is something that's if it doesn't mean anything to you, then just don't worry about it. Okay. it's a fairly well-known procedure in harmonic analysis. Now we did have to goof around with it quite a bit, but anyway, that was not our main achievement here. So if you do the little song and dance here, what you end up with is that it suffices to prove the LP bounds on operators we call phi k and that's the integral of f of y times phi k of y minus x over rx dy, and here I'm using phi k to denote the normalized characteristic function of sk. The idea is that instead of looking at the full maximal operator, for each x, here you pick the translated and rescaled copy of an SK, which comes close to... this is something else that I wanted to sort of brush under the rug. At this point, I should add that we fix the k for the time being. And then eventually we have to add up the bounds over all k. So, that's some extra annoyance in there. But right now, for the time being, the k is going to be fixed. So you look at something like this. But then there's another song and dance that's fairly standard in harmonic analysis, and that's going to be interpolation and duality. Some more work, turns out that it actually suffices to prove LP prime bounds, where P prime is the dual exponent, so that 1 over P plus 1 over P prime is 1. Now I assume that P is greater than 2, so P prime is going to be between 1 and 2. And we're going to be bounding the following operator. I'm going to call it phi k adjoint. Phi star g of y is the integral of g of x phi k of y minus x over rx dx, because you can see how this is a formal adjoint of that. And moreover, it's going to be enough to do it in the case when G is a characteristic function of a set. In that case, we get the integral over a set omega of phi k of y minus x over rx dx. And here G is the characteristic function of omega. The way you go about doing that is you prove the L1 and L2 bounds, and then interpolate between them to get LP prime bounds in this range. Now, in case you wanted to ask, that there are several different places through this whole procedure where you lose the endpoints. So we do not get to keep these. But we do want to prove these bounds at this stage. The L1 bound is basically trivial. So what you do is you just integrate that in X. In Y, right? And then you use Fubini and bound it. Nothing to it. The hard part is to prove the L2 bound. And that relies on some information that we need to have about the intersections of translated and rescaled copies of R sets. So basically what we need to do is estimate the size of intersections of the form, say, x plus rx sk intersected with y plus ry sk. We want to know the size of that, and specifically we would like to know that this is going to be smaller than each of these sets. And now this is where we come to the actual construction of the sets SK. Basically, this is not something that you can expect if you take just any set. So there's some work that needs to go into that. Now, the SKs are constructed, as I described here above, the Cantor type iteration. Now, let's look at what the intersections are going to look like. So take the intersections at step one. Now, let's say for simplicity that the scaling factors are equal. Then what you have is two copies of the same set. One is translated relative to the other. You have some intervals here, some intervals there, something like that. Now, what we need to do is randomize the construction. We're going to make the choice of intervals random so that each one has a probability of staying alive at this step about n to the minus 1, sorry, n1 to the minus epsilon 1. Then pick an interval here. Well, what's the probability that it's going to belong to the intersection? Well, it has to be in this set, and it also has to be in this set. So basically, it's the probability that both this interval and also some other interval somewhere here are going to have been chosen. So then the size of the intersection. Or rather, the intersection is going to have about n to the 1 minus 2 epsilon 1 intervals, and that's less than n to the 1 minus epsilon 1, so we have a gain. And that's unless X and Y are too close. Because in that case, the two sets are basically going to be almost identical. Now, what happens at the further stages of the iteration? Let's just look at step 2 very quickly. Okay, before I move on to step 2, if Rx is not equal to Ry, then you can have some overlap here. Without necessarily x minus y being that small, but we can deal with that. Okay, now step 2. Let's say that our two copies of the set are situated like so. So we have an interval here, here, here. And now consider situations where we get a contribution to the intersection. So let's say that we have two overlapping intervals, say these two or these two. Now at the second step, the choices of the sub-intervals are again going to be randomized. Now, suppose that you're in a situation like this, where an interval here intersects a different interval of the translated set. Then the subsets here are basically two independently chosen random sets. And then you can expect the intersection to be small, basically for this reason. And then we're left with considering this case. Now here, we don't really get much of a gain. We can't do better than the trivial bound. So this is bad. But on the other hand, what we can prove is that this doesn't happen very often. And that's because if you have a lot of these, then the translation and dilation parameters both need to be close. So basically here we use only the trivial bound, but we can, there's a limit on how often this can happen. Here the randomization kicks in. This is somewhat similar to the scheme of Bourguin's proof, and we use some of his terminology here, transverse intersections and internal tangencies. And the last thing I want to say is that if you the circular maximal theorem. And the last thing I want to say is that if you want to push it down to p greater than 1, then you need to look at multiple intersections, correlations between, say, n translated and rescaled copies of your sets. Thank you very much for your attention.